actually studies this. Then I give some very brief background on what is Fibonacci anions, what's the computational model in this case, and how actually to do computation with them. Then this brings to actual definition of single qubit operations. And then I will show the main part, which is how to compile arbitrary single qubit operation into circuits for Fibonacci anions, situating lower bounds in probabilistic polynomial time. And I conclude with actually experimental results of this algorithm implemented in software and just showing some graphs how it works. Well, so first, why actually I'm interested in studying this problem for compiling for topological quantum computers. So it's what's really interested in it about it that this is a way how you can do universal and fault tolerant computation in the same time if you use Fibonacci anions, or you can build hardware that also like by design is protects some of your operations and makes them fault tolerant, like for example for Ising anions, which gives you Clifford group. And so I'm actually here concentrating on the case where you can purely by topological computation do the like universal computation. So why, you know, what's the goal of this talk is actually what was known before. This is a generic approach. If you want to compile some single qubit operation and basically approximate it using elementary gates that you get from Fibonacci anions model, you will need to log to 3 plus delta 1 over epsilon operations to achieve precision epsilon. And the lower bound is just log 1 over epsilon. So the question actually, is it possible to compile and approximate things just using log 1 over epsilon gates? And if it can be actually done efficiently. So, and in this talk, I actually provide the answer to this question. That's the interesting moment about Fibonacci anions. It was like a long time that it was proposed, but recently there was actually a proposal how to do it experimentally. So there is a paper describing how one might engineer physical systems which has these quasi-particles. So this is also there is other part of motivation. So there was a progress on solving similar problem for Clifford NT gates, which is one probably the most widespread gate set in fault tolerant quantum computing. And there was also considered slightly different gate set, Clifford plus V, that which also can be done in the same setting of classical fault tolerant protocols. And there's kind of natural question, actually, how far this kind of techniques can be generalized, and was some generic mathematical tools behind them. And so this is provides some very interesting example, whereas actually, in many senses, you know, the high level picture is very similar, but many details are different, and I will show basically in which ways they're different. So this is just to show, kind of announce the result, how it works. So this is number, for example, that you get if you use this new method to compile. So you just need 458 gates to achieve 10 to minus 30. And if you do estimates for how Solvay-Kitaev would perform in this case, it would be like 5 to by 10 to the fifth gate. So this, I think this kind of separation can even like one day say, okay, maybe if you don't have this kind of compilation algorithm, that it might be not worth even to build these models, because we cannot compile very well for them, and there will be very large overhead in compiling, or it actually might be the other way around. Oh, yeah, sorry, it's, yeah, so basically, yeah, I should probably say this differently. So the problem I'm looking at, so given some single qubit unitary operation, right, one actually wants to approximate it with a finite gate set provided by Fibonacci anions. And actually, the process of finding this approximation I am calling compiling. So this is an analogy, you know, like you have some more high-level operation on a computer, and you want to do this operation in some like gate, some operations that are supported by this computer. So this is kind of some kind of analogy.
For example, in Fibonacci anion, we can do the grading to operate some unitary matrix.
Yes.
And you ask, can I operate this unitary matrix using certain single qubits operation or double qubits operation? How many gates do I need to efficiently approximate this unitary matrix produced by Fibonacci anion?
Yeah, so
that's a goal.
Yeah, basically this is, I will go further, actually define how you, what's your computational basis in Fibonacci anion model, how you perform operations on computational basis. And basically this translates, so this, what I call sigma gates on this graph, is the number of actual moves, number of grading operations you need to perform.
It's the other way around what you said. You have a unitary matrix, and you want to get close to it by grading. So the question of
okay.
How many crossings you have.
Oh, I see. For Fibonacci model, the grading is your operation.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
how many grading you need to approximate a certain unitary matrix.
Yeah.
And then you can compare that to how many quantum circuit you need to approximate unitary matrix. I see. So what is general expectation? Is that these two about the same? I mean, only differ by log or something?
Let's move a little bit further, like in describing. Yeah, let's just postpone this question because I'll just, you know, introduce some definitions and it will be just a little bit easier to answer it like in a few minutes. Okay, so yeah, first basically what I'm doing, what's actually the system we have, right? It's n quasi-particles on the plane, and we need to know two things kind of to describe the system. What is the state space, and how the operations on this system are described in terms of state space. Or in other words, what's the Hilbert space where particles live, and what are unitaries corresponding to operations on these particles. So what a unit is actually corresponding to braiding. Right? And what is kind of interesting here and what is being slightly different from what we're used to in usual quantum computing. So once you have two Fibonacci anions, the Hilbert space that will describe two of them won't be precisely a tensor product of Hilbert spaces for each of them. And the dimension of the system will scale like a golden fraction to the n instead of 2 to the n. So basically, I'm going back to the next question actually, okay, we have this exponentially scaling Hilbert space. Now we need to embed computational Hilbert space, which has this dimension 2 to the n, into Fibonacci anions Hilbert space. And to do this, we basically need to define computational basis and to define how we do operations on this computational basis. So for Fibonacci anions, there are two particle types. Type 0 is no particle, and 1 is the only particle in the model. And there is a fusion rule, which says that if you combine two particles together and then do experiment to determine what the type of particle you get, what's the collective type of these two particles, there are two options. It can be either no particle, either one particle. And this is also what is kind of very different from conventional physics, because you know, if you take two fermions, then you always get a boson, so there is no uncertainty in this. And this is, you know, leads to how the computation is performed. First, let's look at two particles, right? And possible states for them, either when two of them has collective charge zero, or two of them has collective charge one. And what's important to say is that if you measure collective charge, it's basically like a projective measurement. So if you took some two particles and do a measurement and got zero, every time you perform this measurement again, you again get zero, and the same for one. Right? And the operation that actually does something is a particle exchange. So we kind of move particles around each other. And so this picture here, it shows kind of in time how you move them on the plane. And this is trajectories. So this is kind of, you know, time goes up, right? And you exchange two particles, and depending on collective charge, they will get a different phase here. So for collective charge zero, it's e to minus 4 pi over 5, and for collective charge one, it's 3 pi over 5. And so this is, next, actually, to define our qubits, two particles is not enough, and we are looking at three particles to actually define a computational basis. So, and how we can basically look at particle states, we can take two particles, right, first two, and look at their collective charge, and then look at the collective charge of all three of them, right? And depending on these collective charges, we'll have basically three different states. Right, because state 0, 0 is not possible, because if we have zero here, the only possibility for fusion is to get one. Right, and then there is a question. Okay, we defined a basis for our Hilbert space of three particles, and the question is a proper definition. So, isn't there some kind of arbitrary thing here? Because we choose to combine these two together, right? And we could have combine these two, right? And this is what is described by fusion matrix, right? So if, F matrix is basically a property of any given property of any anionic model, right? And it allows you to translate between different types of bases. And for example, for this model, if you have 0, 1, 1, 1, it's translated like this into the other basis. Fusion matrix also defined in terms of inverse of golden fraction. So, and actually, this knowledge is enough to understand how to define a single qubit and what's the operations that we can do on it. Right? Okay. So, yeah, and this is just to kind of short remark to show that in case of if you have many particles, right? So this is a way you can define Hilbert space, describing all of them, and basically you get all possible B strings here, but you cannot have two zeros following each other, because fusing zero with one always gives you one. So therefore, the number of these strings is precisely Fibonacci numbers, and they scale like phi to the n. Okay, so now I'm actually going to definition of qubits and computational basis and operations. So I use three particles as a qubit, right? And there are two operations. Exchanging first two and exchanging second one and third one. So first one corresponds to these two phases, as we've seen before. And to compute the second one, basically need to go to the other basis, then use this for other basis and go back. So this gives us conjugation by F matrix. So this is a representation of two operations that we perform on the qubit. So it's basically two single qubit gates that we have. And here we actually can see that what makes this model challenging, that you can actually not do even like bit flip exactly. So such a like simple operation like poly x cannot be done exactly in this basis. Yeah, and this is some also motivation to why actually studying single qubit case is important, because like building blocks for single qubit case are used to implement two qubit gates, and this shows, for example, how you can implement C nodes using some single qubit primitives. And this just achieves precision 2 to 10 minus 3 and 5 to 10 to minus 3. And actually, if you would use like, would aim for more, you will it will give you a serious blow up in the complexity because of application of Soloveitchi-Tayev algorithm. Right? And so now I'm actually going to the main part of my talk. So yeah, actually, do I answer your question? Basically, how this all works. So first, I start with general unitary single qubit that is an input. Then I round off it to unitary that can be done exactly with these two gates, sigma 1 and sigma 2. After that, I use exact synthesis algorithm that, based on this exact unitary, produces FT circuit. So FT is just slightly different gate cells that is more convenient for these purposes than based on this generators of braid group. So, and here is an intermediate step that basically performs translation from this one to this one. But what's important, then, these two gate sets are equivalent, so there is a way to express both these matrices in terms of this and vice versa. And first, I start with exact synthesis part. Right, and so these are actually this F and T gates, right? Why I call it T gate is somewhat similar to what we used to in Clifford and T model, but instead of A's root of unity, here is a tens root of unity. And F gate is also looks somewhat similar to Hadamard, and this is inverse of golden fraction, and this square root of inverse of
so
golden fraction.
F gate, T gate are available.
These two gates can be simply expressed into like as a braid partitions.
Okay.
Just this corresponds to three braid operations, and this corresponds to I think also either three or slightly more. And basically, you know, in the end, on that like last step, what I do, I actually kind of rewrite everything from this into this braid generators and do some optimization on braid generators itself. Okay. And to understand basically, to describe what can be exactly synthesized. So by exactly synthesized, what I mean is that these are unitaries that can be exactly represented as a braid pattern, right? And so the first object that I need is a integer extension of tens root of unity, and it can be described as this sum, right, where A0 are integer coefficients, and these are powers of tens root of unity. So it turns out that like fourth power can be expressed in turn like this, and fifth power is minus 1, therefore we just need like expression here up to the third power. And here's how the most general form of the unitary looks like. So we have two parameters uv, this both integers extended by tens root of unity. You know, interesting detail here is this square root of tau is kind of just like a symbol. Basically, it kind of, so this is, it doesn't take part in the like algorithm itself, but it defines just how we do the operation. So, and it was kind of one of important steps in this in solving this kind of question, was the exactly synthesizable unitaries to remove the square root of tau outside of the problem, because it just makes this object much simpler, because otherwise you will have something more complicated, right? And basically the statement that any unitary, we call unitary exactly synthesizable if it's of this form and there is extra condition on UV, which is corresponds to the condition that unitary must be normalized. And here is just an example of FT squared, how it looks like. Okay, the second object that we need is a real ring of integers. It's basically a real subring of Z omega. And it's basically integers A0 plus I1 multiplied by inverse of golden fraction. Right? And that's the important mapping that plays kind of crucial role here is Galois automorphism of ring of integers. And it defined, it maps inverse of golden fraction to the negative of golden fraction and leaves integers unchanged. So basically, and the third thing that is kind of also important here is the complexity measure. So this is defines how complex our unitary is. So basically, how difficult to make a braid, how long will be the braid pattern that we need to actually get this unitary. And the main results of this section is that any unitary of that form can be represented as a braid pattern, and this also can be done efficiently. So there is an efficient algorithm for finding that braid pattern. And so on this slide is just some intuition to show, you know, just consider powers of F tau and show what the value of complexity measure. So you see that it's basically rapidly growing. I will show later that it's actually exponentially fast. The growth here is exponential. Yeah, and here is the algorithm. Right. So basically, we start with exactly synthesizable unitary. And while complexity measure of the first entry is greater than 1, we just try 10 matrices, Ft to the m, right, and pick the one that reduces the complexity measure the most. So it's kind of greedy algorithm that reduces complexity measure by picking this kind of generator on each step. Right, and I discussed before that these generators are exactly representable as braid patterns. So in the end, algorithm terminates and it gives, in the end, gives mu u equal to 1, which corresponds to powers of omega. So this way we can start from a unitary and just write down the braid pattern and do it in time logarithmic in the value of complexity measure. I will show now why. And so basically the important property to look at that how this, you know, how basically multiplying by these generators will change the complexity measure. And so this is expression that we get after generation, after multiplication by generator. That's the important thing, that actually complexity measure of one entry define completely the complexity measure of the other entry. Right? And this is some kind of intuition. Basically, if we have these two entries UV, we can write down some complex unit vectors corresponding to them. And by choice of k here, we just adjust the angle basically between these vectors. And by adjustment, we can we aim basically to come to as orthogonal to one of them as possible to minimize the inner product between vectors. So this is basically how how we can show that by choice of k, we can always make this ratio smaller than 0.32 on each step. So this gives us basically exponentially fast reduction of complexity measure. And this is just a picture how it looks, how this value of this inner product will look like for different alpha and beta. And this is what happens when we pick kind of the smallest one. And this also shows that it's bounded on the other side, so it cannot be larger than the form. This expression cannot be larger as one on itself, and therefore, once we have a circuit and we multiply, add some gates into the end, we cannot grow more than exponentially faster. It kind of gives a two-way bound between complexity measure and the length of the braid pattern. Okay, so and basically once we have exact synthesis, we want to now approximate unitaries with exactly synthesizable ones. And here is kind of two important special cases, and anything else can be broken down up to this one. So in one case, when we have non-zero entry here, right, then it can be broken down as this product in terms of F matrix and RZ. And if you have zero entry here, this is another special case, which is RZ phi X, and basically X gate also falls in this special case. Well, so first I kind of come to what's the target function. So this is a trace invariant, global phase invariant trace distance, right? So it has module here to make it global phase invariant, right? And for this special case, it can be represented like just real part of X multiplied by E phi over 2, and basically need to solve this kind of this minimization problem for X under some additional constraints. Oh, sorry, it must be a U. For U under additional constraints when UV are from Z omega, and this unitary is normalized, basically U squared plus V squared tau equal to 1.
What was X?
Yeah, it's, sorry, it's U, actually. Okay. It's type. Yeah, and so basically the most kind of difficult part here is this constraint, right? Because so U and V are both of them are defined by four integers, right? So basically to check if this constraint is satisfied, you need to solve a system of Diophantine equations if you expand everything in terms of integers. But on the other hand, there is a nice, very nice theory about this kind of problems, which is called relative norm equations. Now I'm going to show. Basically, this is what is in our case relative norm equation looks like. So we, for U, we fix U, and we just interested if there is a V such that it's equal to A plus B tau. Right, and this is this is called relative norm equation between Z omega and Z tau. And some kind of very simple observation here, and at the same time important, that absolute value squared is multiplicative function, right? And it's really simple, but this the same observation goes through many similar kind of problems. If you look at something that very ancient, like Lagrange four squares theorem, it's basically the same thing, but for quaternions. And if you look at the problem of representing numbers as the sum of two squares, it will be Gaussian integers here instead. So solving this problem goes down to factorization of this right hand side, right? And kind of to be more precise, first I need kind of to address the problem: what does it mean to factor in this kind of numbers, right? And what does the prime for these numbers mean, right? So the main tool is a norm here, which is defined like this, and basically. I call number prime if its norm is a prime number. So a norm is actually maps these integers from the tau to usual integers. And in this way, we can define prime numbers. And basically, if you want to solve this norm equation in general, what you would do, you would take, compute the norm, factor it, then using, based on like usual factors, you will find corresponding factors of these numbers, and then you will solve norm equation for each of these cases. And by multiplicativity, you can get the whole result back. So, but you know, here, like here, I'm interested in an efficient solution, right? And I already like brought factoring, which is known to be a hard problem. And it turns out there is like a way to go kind of around this. So one can actually aim only for easy cases of the problem. So I think there's kind of analogy. Imagine you're playing the game, right? And somebody asks you to factor numbers. And he just gives you random numbers from like interval from 0 to m. And it turns out that actually it's not that bad game because there is a prime number theorem that says that density of primes is m over log m. So this basically means that you will succeed in log m steps. So it's actually, you know, trying to factor numbers, it's when they randomly given to you, it's not, you know, that difficult problem. And also it's the case because there is efficient way to, there are polynomial time algorithms that allows you to check if the number is prime or not, right? And therefore we aim here for easy cases where the norm is expressed as like 5 to some power r multiplied by p, where is p prime number, right? And there is additional requirement for this equation to be solvable that we will satisfy automatically that, of course, right-hand side must be positive. And the other thing is that Galois conjugate of right-hand side also must be possible, must be positive. This is because actually you can commute Galois conjugation through module absolute value squared and get the other equation just with conjugation here. And so here's basically I describe how we actually sample this. So basically what we do, we consider good approximations already just and randomly sample them. Once we come up with some sample, we check if it's the easy case. If it's the easy case, we solve norm equation in probabilistic polynomial time, and we are done. So basically, you know, important problem here is actually how to do the sampling, right? And this gray region shows basically all, you know, the region which corresponds to U. So this is complex plane, and this region shows all U that gives inequality less or equal epsilon. Right, and we choose this kind of parallelogram just to simplify sampling procedure. Right, and I'll show how to sample basically points from this parallelogram, and they by default will satisfy this condition and also the positivity condition from the previous slide. Right, and this is how it looks like in reality. Right, because usually you consider very small epsilons, right? So this is will be some very tiny block here. This is angle that corresponds to Earth's rotation that you want to approximate, right? And basically you split this parallelogram into small blocks, and you choose, and you can choose always one point inside this parallelogram, right? And once you sample, there are like basically three cases when it's not solvable, when it's solvable, but it's difficult instance, and when it's easily solvable. And basically, we rely on some kind of conjecture, number theoretical conjecture, that in our sampling process, the distribution of easy instances is the same as distribution of primes on the interval 0, m. Right? And So, and this is actually how the sampling is performed, right? So, first it starts with just cell center, then y coordinate is approximated by number of this form. So this is done using continued fractions. So kind of on a high level, once approximate tau by using continued fraction by rational number, and then find this coefficient using that rational number, right? And once y coordinate approximated, then we compute x coordinate, also approximated, find the closest point of this form, basically, and get our sample. So this is relies on the following fact, that for any real x, it can be approximated by expression like this, a plus b tau with precision tau to n, of order tau to n. So kind of important thing also to look here, basically kind of count the number of bits we are using, right? Because, so for example, on this picture, so we have here epsilon squared. So this number is of order 1 over epsilon, right? And this is this number of order 1 here. And basically, the size of each cell is the order of 1 over epsilon. And the size of each cell is like order of epsilon. And the number of cells is order 1 over epsilon. So we have pretty big choice of random samples. And in the same time as we, so we can use just, you know, of order n bits to achieve precision. So achieve precision of order like tau to the n. Right? This way, basically, kind of complexity of so basically to get precision of order like exponent 1 over phi to the n, we just need to of order n bits. Okay. So here are some basically experimental results from implementing the software. So I implemented it in C++ and used PyroGP to solve norm equations. So this is a number theoretic package that allows you to solve basically any kind of norm equation. So, and this is comparison to brute force search. So we see that basically for RZ approximations by brute force, you can only get like around, the difference in angular coefficient is just around like maybe 16%. And here the difference in angular coefficient is just 20% from the kind of the best thing you can get just like by brute force search. So here is the scaling, basically kind of going further up to the precision of 10 to minus 100. So basically algorithm allows to get this kind of approximations on just on usual desktop computer. This shows that actually results are pretty stable in number of gates. So I, for example, here I take a lot of random trials and just see what the minimal and maximal quality I get along like several trials, and it stays pretty stable. Well, and okay, and here is runtime of the algorithm. So there are different runtime of different stages. So synthesis stage, which is exact synthesis algorithm, where synthesis is optimization, and approximation stage is finding approximations without solving norm equation, and norm equations separately shown how long time actually to takes to solve this easy instances of norm equation or decides that it's not an easy instance. And we see that all like fits actually coefficient in runtime is around like between 1.5 and 2, which is also better than Slovakia-Tayev algorithm, which gives around like I think 2.8 something in the runtime scaling. Okay. Yeah, so here's my conclusions. Basically, I've shown efficient exact synthesis algorithm, for example, synthesizable unitaries, also algorithms that saturate the asymptotic lower bound on the on the number of gates as a function of quality of approximation, and also there is a software that basically implements all this. It works now and can be used, you know, right away once we have Fibonacci anions implemented in some hardware. Yep, thank you. Yeah, this is it.
So that was all for single qubit gates.
Yes.
So how much of that carries over to qubit gates?
So there are constructions. So I'll just go to this slide. Okay. Yeah. To carry these things to multiple qubit things, there is one kind of basic additional step that needs to be done, and we are working on it. So this, you see that here is like only one particle moves around, right? So this is the variant when you actually compile into things that are with one mobile particle. It turns out once you can do things like this, it's kind of easy to do some multi-qubit operations. And currently, it's just a slightly different generator set corresponding to one mobile particle as opposed to allowing to move all of them around. And this is kind of problem we are working on now. We expect actually that it should be results along the same lines for one mobile particle.
Okay, but I mean, is it still the case that the exactly synthesizable gates have entries in these rings, or?
This question could be a little bit, basically, they should be in the same ring, right? Because F matrix and R matrix for Fibonacci model are from these rings, right? So the only thing that the square root of tau should be taken with care, right? But I would expect that should be something similar, but you know, we haven't moved to that part yet. So, but in worst case, it's just slightly larger rings that includes a square root of tau.
I guess another thing that I would guess happens with the two qubit gates, which you managed to avoid with the one qubit gate, is going outside of the qubit Hilbert space, right? I mean, the actual Hilbert space of six particles is more than four dimensional.
These constructions, I know there is this problem of going outside computational Hilbert space, but I think, I'm not sure about this construction if it actually takes you away, but on the other hand, you can still argue that if you approximate with required precision, you're kind of still close to the your Hilbert space, so it shouldn't be things that will stop you actually from doing multi-qubit case.
So you're giving an algorithm for doing this log 1 over epsilon approximation using these particular one qubit gates. There is a very general non-constructive results using basic gate spectral calculations, which shows that any universal unitaries with algebraic entries allow a log 1 over epsilon approximation. With any unitaries with algebraic entries. So my question is, do you have any intuition for in how far your algorithm generalizes to other universal unitaries? Because it seems to me that the only thing that you're really using is the fact that the tau is in degree two in degree two number and some very general properties of Euclidean domains.
Yeah, I think so. Basically, you know, like I mean, one thing like here is that basically you need actually to like you know, if you study like Clifford and TKs, right, and study this, right, there are like two differences which are kind of really big. So here, all your entries are actual algebraic integers, right? And in Clifford and TKs, your entries are not algebraic integers. They're like algebraic integers divided by powers of two. Right? So, and for example, because of this, exact synthesis part of becomes very different. So in HTKs for exact synthesis, you actually like introduce very different complexity measure, which is actually looks at these powers of in the denominator. And in that setting, the proof is actually totally different, that you can do efficient exact synthesis. So I would say that actually exact synthesis is kind of the less clear part for me, how it can be generalized or how it can be extended and what concept it is related to. Because like other part, like approximation and well, norm equation is like it's very generic theory for like, you know, basically it's, you have like two any relative extension, and there is like way how to solve norm equations and relative extensions, just, you know. And so for approximation, right, actually it's also like here is different between HT case and here. So here we, it's enough for us to kind of treat separately real and imaginary part. And for example, in HT case, you cannot do that, and there is some additional constraints that you need to satisfy. And it actually looks pretty similar to, you know, some Minkowski bound that you have like a kind of integer lattice, and you need to appoint inside some convex body. So that's, for HT case, there's some kind of similarity to that problem in approximation part. You know, I'm kind of interested in possible generalization of this, and that's why I'm looking at this example. It's kind of one of the motivation. I would say that, you know, I don't yet have like, you know, general intuition to cover even like to combine this case, for example, with Clifford's and TKs.
More questions already? If not, then let's give them a hand again.